Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
We're going to be covering architectural design of Khufu's Great Pyramid. So we're going to be talking about the Great Pyramid, amongst other things to do with the pyramid and just general life and lifestyle during that time. Now, we've got a expert here who's written some great articles, and his website, of course, is up on our website as well, so it's one click and you'll get his ebooks and articles and all sorts of information, great pictures as well. And that is Cheo, so CHEOPSPYRAMID.com. And again, that's on the website for us old guys that can hardly read. And our guest, well, here he is, the one and only Manu Safzad.
Hello, Al. Safzadeh.
You know, you're lucky. Actually, you got me on. You know, some of the other hosts, they'd be so accurate, and I'm not.
Well, you got the first four letters. That's a start.
That's a start. You know, I think that, you know, I think it's funny because I came from a French culture, and I learned, and then English became second language, and now I'm trying to learn back English for the show, and it doesn't always work.
Well, my last name is maybe not the right thing to practice English with, so because it isn't an English name to begin with, it's an Iranian name. So my father is Iranian, my mom is German. And just like you, I actually grew up in Germany and in Iran, and English is my third language.
Oh, crazy, hey?
Yeah.
I just noticed it in places like when I'm traveling around the world and I'll say something and then they'll guess where I'm from, but it's not really right. It's where I've learned to speak that English word.
Yeah. Well, the easiest way to remember, as I was saying, is saves the day, saves Zade. That's the best way. But we'll stick with Manu, first name.
He saves the day.
Right.
So you had Iranian and German. So were you always interested in this sort of subject, you know, of architectural design and or the pyramids?
No, not at all. I made just very peripherally, like many of us, we watch TV, History Channel, Discovery Channel, and there's interesting programs about history. And some of those programs dealing with Egypt, I always like to watch them. But no, never to this detail. That all started maybe 7-8 years ago, could have been 10 years ago, when I read The Orion Mystery by Robert Bouval. I think that was the first step that got me much more interested than before. And then I did a little bit more reading, not much more, watched a few maybe documentaries. One of the documentaries that really got me was The Pyramid Code by the 5-part series. That was very haunting for me to watch. I love that. And then about 2 years ago, I really got very heavily into Egyptology and the Great Pyramid, and I wrote a book. A book came out of that in 2016, and since then it's been almost more than a hobby.
What is it about Egyptology that has kept you on, kind of like captured you?
Well, it's the original House of Mystery, Al, the Great Pyramid. I think it has a way to get people. And that's from a distance on TV and from reading books. And then when you go to Egypt and you stand in front of it, it's impossible to escape the grips. It's such an amazing place, the Giza Plateau, and the other monuments in Egypt as well. So not just Giza, it just grabs you and it won't let you go.
But what about it? I think what I get at is there's other lost civilizations or, you know, times that where people have had great life and, you know, wealth. And
yes.
What is it about the Egyptian? Is it the whole lifestyle? Is it the way that they dressed, behaved, worked within the world? Was there anything in particular, do you think?
Yeah, that's an evolving experience for me, because I'm also now learning the language. So if you ask me now, part of that is that you can gain an insight into how they were thinking. You get a glimpse of it at least by reading by learning how to read what they said, by looking at the inscriptions and the monuments, and then of course the art is incredible. But also the mystery of the architecture. So the monuments are monumental, and they to this day we're still mystified by how they made them. In some cases, we could not reproduce it now, and I think that's a lot of the mystery there. There's monuments all over the world, and people now are looking at that to see when they were built, and that's of course that's another problem, is because you can't date monuments built of stone, because you can't date the stone, and so that further adds to the mystery. And then all these esoteric connections between the monuments and astronomy, it's a big stew, and you know, once you take a sip of it, and then especially when you go to Egypt, then you get caught up in it, and it's a lot of fun.
Wow, certainly sound incredibly interesting. Now, you've been spending a lot of time there in the last few years, and I was going to say, have you noticed a change in the way that it is to visit and work in Egypt over all of the last turmoil over the last years?
I've been there twice now, and that was long after the turmoil. The turmoil was 7, 8, almost 8 years ago. I went there in 2018, and I just came back last month, and the answer to your question is no. I felt completely safe. It's a great experience. You never feel for your safety. in that sense. There's a lot of police presence, tourist police. So they do a good job giving you that feeling that the tourists are safe. Of course, I wasn't there before the revolution, so I can't give you a comparison. But I have no complaints. I felt I can easily go back and not be worried about it.
Great. Now, I don't want to get in politics or anything like that either.
Yeah.
But the day-to-day, like when you go there and you're working and everything, you feel totally safe, everything's fine, no weird stuff, and any major adaptions you have to make before you go to a place like Egypt?
First of all, I wanted to say, you're asking what you feel weird. No, the Egyptian people are lovely. You make friends. You have just amazing experiences, and everybody has their own most likely set of experiences. But I can tell you that the two times that I've been there, it was just lovely. Special preparations: you have to dress for heat. You have to remember it's a desert climate, and many people have never been to the desert. So you have to just dress up according to the climate. You probably run into a lot of vendors, especially on the Giza Plateau, and you just have to kind of get used to that. That's part of the interaction with the local people. They want you to go on camel rides and carriage rides. They want to sell you little gifts, and some people might not be comfortable with that in the beginning, but they mean well. I think that's something you get easily used to, but that's something you may not encounter in other places that you go. And I can't recommend it more than I have already. It's just a lovely place to go, and you'll have a wonderful time.
Yeah. Now you go, and you have been going to try to answer some questions and try to investigate.
Yes.
And you were talking about the Great Pyramid. But before we go to the Great Pyramid, when you first get to Egypt and when you're first out there on the field, what is the most exciting thing you see, or what's the overall impression you get? Is there just tons of architectural design that you just can't stop looking at? Give us an overview of, getting there.
Yeah. If you are in Giza, if you're in the neighborhood, the village around Giza, if you're in a hotel, let's say, and you have a pyramid view, you get a feel for the size of these pyramids. There are mountains. And then, of course, when you go to the Giza, your jaw just drops. It happened when I was there the second time. Now, I went up to the Giza Plateau, I think, 5-6 times and just walked around the whole day. It's a very peaceful place. So first your jaw drops, and then once you're over your first overwhelming experience, and then you start exploring things, then it's just a great place to walk around for a whole day, and you won't be able to finish it in a day. Easily, you need 3 days to at least see all the main things on the Giza Plateau. And then in other places in Egypt, you have some very, very endearing experiences. For example, when I was in Luxor and we went to Hatshepsut's temple, up in her, in the inner sanctuary, the artwork has just, it's like it's speaking to you. Very endearing, the style of the artwork. I had an amazing experience in her temple. And then recently, so this last trip, I got to see the Abu Sir pyramids, and I went into the mortuary temple, what's left of it, of Sahura, and I had another sort of flavor experience. It's very peaceful, very, very serene place. Maybe the most serene place in Egypt I've been to is the mortuary temple. So, and everybody has different experiences like that in different sites. And that's the beauty of it. There's so many things to see, and there's so many different flavors of experiences that there's something for everyone there.
So now we're going to go to the Great Pyramid. Now, Khufu's a Great Pyramid. There's been stories that, you know, the main ones I've heard through days is that, you know, aliens created the pyramid, mm-hmm. or other groups had designed the pyramid, and then there's Khufu. How do you stand on that? Who built the pyramid?
I'm keeping an open mind, Al, because right. I've been taught in my life that you can be convinced of something, and then you get proven wrong. So, and of course, I have a science training, and when you go through a science training, that gets hammered into you that you can't take anything for granted. You always have to question everything. So I look at the current, the mainstream model of history as just that, as a model. And that model says that the Great Pyramid was ordained by Khufu and designed by Hemiunu, his vizier. And that is the model. But is that the truth 100% and nothing but the truth? I don't know. My contribution in all of that is to look for evidence, and I go with the evidence. That's my only guide, and otherwise I have to keep an open mind and be ready for any surprise that may come my way.
So when you decided to start investigating the Great Pyramid, what was your primary goal for this?
I stumbled into this, Al. I did not have plans to understand the Great Pyramid any more than any of you or your listeners. I one day, I remember this very well, I was sort of curious about how tall the pyramid was and how the base, and I looked at the numbers, and of course the famous numbers come from a British surveyor by the name of Flinders Petrie, and he had published numbers in the imperial system in inches and feet, or inches rather. And then of course you find meter, you find the metric system. But I was looking for the measure that the Egyptians used, because I wanted to know how did they measure things? And that, of course, the answer is cubits. That's what they used. And I found a graphic on the internet that showed the pyramid, as it measures in cubits. And there was a number. The length of the side slope, the technical term in geometry is the apothem. So the apothem is the distance between the midway, when you're at the base, the center, and you go all the way up to the apex, that's called the apothem. And that number was 356 cubits. And I looked at that number and I said to myself, that number reminds me of something. And what did it remind me of? Well, it reminded me of astronomy. And that was that was my stumbling block. And from that little moment, everything took off. In a nutshell, the answer to your question is, when you ask me what is my stance on who designed this, my answer to your question is, whoever designed this had astronomy in mind. And I think I can fit that comfortably into the time of Hemiunu, who I think was the true architect. And of course, I've published papers besides writing this book now after the fact. And in those papers, I have pretty compelling evidence that he was the architect, because his tomb, which sits right next to the Great Pyramid, just maybe a couple of hundred meters west of the Great Pyramid, the dimensions of his own tomb are enshrining the dimensions of the Great Pyramid. And that just blew my mind when I saw that I just published that paper this year. So I'm going with the evidence, and the evidence is telling me astronomy mattered to the Great Pyramid, and the person who designed it put that design into his own tomb.
Wow. So when you decided to go further and really kind of investigate the Great Pyramid, what is it that you wanted to find out? What would be the most interesting to you?
The astronomy is what got me when I first read Robert Bouval's book, The Orion Mystery. That I had heard just like anyone else about the pyramids, but when I read Robert's book that the pyramids were may have been aligned intentionally with the three stars of Orion's belt, I was fascinated by that, because this connection between the ground and the sky, that was just an amazing concept. And so I think that's been with me this whole time. So what you're asking is, what is the specific aspect that's interesting me the most? I think it is how we look at the sky and how we take the sky and bring it down to Earth and make monuments with that knowledge. I think that's my favorite part in all of this.
Now, you are definitely a numbers man.
Yes. So, and language, too. I'm interested in words and numbers. And I wrote that on my website because more recently I've written also a paper with Robert Schock, who you probably know, who's the famous geologist who, with John Anthony West, 27 years ago, proposed that the Great Sphinx is much older than we were being told. And so Robert and I, we published a paper recently about the inventory stela, and that's about words and how to analyze the writings. But this topic, the Great Pyramid, is about numbers.
So how do you take numbers and apply, and when you apply them, what kind of evidence do you get?
Great question. It is about proving intent, right, isn't it? We are trying to figure out what was on the mind of the people that made this monument, whoever they were. And if you have a written piece, then, of course, that proves intent. When somebody tells you, okay, I designed this pyramid based on this idea, then you know what they were thinking. But when you have numbers to deal with, then proving intent is a whole other is a huge problem. And many in the field, a lot of my colleagues, what they have done is they look at the mathematical messages that come out of the Great Pyramid, and they look at the collections of all these interesting mathematical relationships, constants, and then the argument basically goes, how can this be a coincidence? How can all of this be found in the dimensions of the Great Pyramid and just be there by random chance? And I completely agree with them. It's not random chance, but what my main issue is at this point is, how do I prove intent? Because just by proving showing that something is not random chance does not immediately take you to having proven the fact that it was intended. And so my role in all of that is to come up with other explanations how all of these interesting mathematical and geometrical facts can be explained incidentally to some other idea. And I think the connection is astronomy, because with astronomy, you bring in physics. And of course, when you bring in physics, you bring in geometry and mathematics. So I think that's maybe one way you can bridge the two camps, you know, because we have these diametrically opposed camps. We have the orthodox Egyptologists, and then we have the alternative historians, and they're not even talking to each other anymore. They're so opposite. And I'm trying to find some way that we can bring people together and have a scientific discussion with just looking at the facts and seeing if we can come up with some agreements. And so that's kind of how I see my role in all of that.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. Yes.
I spend my life trying to do that and get people to at least, you know, talk.
But, right. Well, as long as it's fun and as long as we're having a good time doing it, Al, I think we'll keep doing it, right?
Of course.
Yeah. Yes.
I love to have people on. I love to talk to everybody I can about anything. And I love to help put them out there and say, listen, we've got a good listenership. Get out there and talk. Speak on the thing. It's a safe place. We're not going to attack anybody. We just want to hear what you have to say. And then, you know, people need, you know, that's the difference. But because as soon as someone said something, it seems like there's a backlash. There's people that just want to attack them.
Yes.
And that's, anyway, but enough of that. So now did you discover anything new in the Great Pyramid, or did you expect to find something new in there?
I did not expect to find anything. I stumbled over it. This is what I was saying with the length of the apotheme, the side slope. So I looked at that number and I saw a period of the moon in it, and so this is the new contribution that I think nobody previously noted, that the dimensions of the Great Pyramid, the base dimensions, may have been based on the period of the moon. And that's something, but it's not the period of the moon that Egyptologists are commonly citing, which is the of course, the shape of the moon that we all see in the night sky, and the month of the moon is when the moon returns to its the same shape where it started. It's a different period that many people don't know about, and that's called the sidereal period. So the sidereal period is the number of days that it takes the moon to come back to a certain position against the map of the stars. And so the moon does not have the same shape, but it's in the same spot compared to the stars. And that's called the sidereal period. And that number has a relation to this dimension that I was describing. And that's kind of my entry point. So, and of course, I go into lots of detail in the book explaining how that rationale came about, and I also explained the geometry, how the cycles that we can observe are geometrically related, and how that exact same geometry we find in the Great Pyramid. And that is what baffled me the most when I saw that the core design of the Great Pyramid, which is a triangle that's composed of the half base, the height, and the side slope, it's called the core triangle, how the geometry of that particular triangle in the Great Pyramid is exactly the same as the geometry that you find relating to astronomical cycles. And I think that is the main contribution that I feel I made to the field. And, you know, if I'm proving...
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When wrong, so be it. But I felt like it had to be said, it had to be published for people to consider it at least. And then, of course, they can disagree with it and they can say safe study is wrong, and that's okay with me. That's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Asking a question is never a bad thing.
Right. Yeah. And I have proof, and I also have proof, of course. I'm not just formulating a theory. I'm basing it on some evidence, and the proposal makes a prediction, and this prediction actually also explains a strange papyrus that was acquired by a German Egyptologist by the name of George Ebers. And this is called the Ebers Papyrus. On the Ebers Papyrus, there's a calendar. And Egyptologists have, for many years, have argued about the meaning of this calendar. And strangely enough, and I did not know anything about this papyrus when I was writing my book. And in the middle of writing the book, I stumbled over this calendar and the controversy regarding how to explain it. And the fascinating thing is the cycle that I am proposing, that's the base of the design of the Great Pyramid, actually locksteps exactly with the calendar that's on this papyrus. And that papyrus was composed 800 years after the Great Pyramid was supposedly built. So I felt like that was a good confirmation that supported the idea that there was such an astronomical supercycle as the one that I'm proposing in the book.
How much more do you expect that we can learn from the Great Pyramid?
Oh my God, lots.
And
the good thing is we are now at a stage where we can non-invasively probe the Great Pyramid. You may have heard of this last year. A scan came out of the Great Pyramid. They found a huge space above the Grand Gallery. And they're scanning again. I just came back from Egypt. I saw the plates, the detector plates in the Grand Gallery. So they're doing it again. And so this gives us a way to be able to learn about the Great Pyramid without even moving one stone, which the Egyptian authorities, of course, they're very antsy about invasive studies because you never know when, you know, how you do something and then the pyramid might get destroyed or part of it might get destroyed. And, of course, a couple of centuries ago when the early explorers went to Egypt, they used explosives to force themselves into the monuments. And there was a lot of looting and vandalism in those days, and that had to stop at some point. And nowadays we have the technology to investigate without destroying, even a little bit. And I think that's a good thing. So you will learn more about the Great Pyramid probably in the next few months. But I just published a paper that predicts there is at least six more spaces inside the Great Pyramid. And so that'll be put to a test then. We'll know in a few months if I'm wrong, right or wrong about it.
In general, those spaces found within something like the pyramid, what was the general purpose of those spaces?
We don't know. Even this big void that was just discovered, all we know is that it's big and that it may be inclined by, similarly as the Grand Gallery. The Grand Gallery it goes up at an angle, obviously, and then it ends in the big step, the Great Step, and then you go horizontally into the King Chamber. And the function of the Grand Gallery is still being debated. Of course, there are theories, one of which is that it was a counterweight pulley system where big stones were hauled up. But there's other theories that, about something else. It could have been an observatory before the pyramid was put over it to look at the stars. Who knows? And so these new spaces inside the pyramid, just the same. No idea, but that's the beauty of it. That's, you find something new and then you have to investigate it somehow. You know, you heard about the robot that went into the shafts and found a door years ago.
Right.
Yeah. And so what's behind the door? Well, we don't know. As far as we know, nobody's looked past the first obstacle. But is there papyruses behind the door? Is there a statue? Is there a mummy? We have no idea. But one day, maybe we'll find out.
Wow. Now, what takes him so long to find out? Like, when you discover something like that, why isn't it something that's relatively quickly announced what it is?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's the information flow that comes out of Egypt I think they're trying to control the information flow for good or bad reasons. Some people may say it's good, some people it's bad, and I don't want to be a judge of it. I think the problem is that when somebody makes a discovery, immediately in Egypt, because it's such a hot topic in the world, you get all these different interpretations, and maybe the ministry wants to get a handle on it and not have the wrong idea get out. I mean, I got a little bit of a taste of this. I have a YouTube channel. I put a YouTube video, and then a few months later, it was being cited in a tabloid newspaper with a spin that I completely did not intend. So I know that how things can sort of get out of proportion, and maybe that's what the authorities are worried about. So they want to keep a control over the flow of information, and I understand that to some point. Now the scientists, the archaeologists, the scholars, the people that go there, they are free to, of course, publish. When they find something, they can publish it. And just like the team, the multinational team did that scanned the pyramid, they published it in Nature magazine, in Nature journal, their findings. And so they are free, of course, to publish it. And then you can have all the people come in and add their spin to it. That's okay. But I think that's the commercialization of the information, of course, is also important. And so you add all of this together, you're not dealing with a purely scientific environment where, you know, information is supposed to flow freely, because there's all this these extra layers of complication added on top. I think that's why you have what you're seeing. It takes time for news to get out Yeah. I think that explains it.
Oh yeah. Now, so during your time, what has been the most, let's just say, surprising to you that you've learned while you've been doing this investigation?
Well, I think the biggest surprise was the architect's tomb. There have been a lot of moments when I should mention two things that have come up in the last couple of months where my jaw just dropped. So the one thing is that the tomb of Hemiunu may itself be an architectural blueprint. That was a shocker when I saw that. And of course I published it, and I'm going back to Egypt to verify it. So the proposal that I made makes a prediction. And I'm hoping that I can find the physical proof of it at the actual Mastaba tomb. And I've applied for a permit with the authorities to go back and have them allow me to visit the tomb and do an inspection. That was one shocker. Another shocker, which came out of the paper with Robert Schock, just a few months ago about the inventory stela, was that we looked at the inventory stela, for those who don't know, is first of all a limestone plate that has an inscription on it that says that Khufu went to Giza, repaired the Sphinx, repaired the Temple of Isis, and built his pyramid, and that of his queen. So this is the only written record that we have that actually explicitly says that Khufu built a pyramid. And the part of that inscription that's interesting to Robert Schock and myself is the Sphinx part. So because if Khufu knew the Sphinx, that means the Sphinx couldn't have been made by Khafre, who was the son of Khufu. And Egyptologists in general are not crediting the inventory stela. They think it's not on a historical record. They think it's basically made up by priests of the late period to attract business to the Temple of Isis, at Giza. But we are countering that theory. So we wrote a long paper taking apart the orthodox thesis step by step. And so now I'm going to get to the answer to your question. Sorry about the long-winded answer. What was the shocker? Well, the shocker came when we looked at the pyramid texts. The pyramid texts are, of course, the religious documents written inside of the pyramids of the pyramid of Unas and the Sixth Dynasty kings. And so we analyzed a section of text in the pyramid of Unas that's called the mouth opening ceremony, where it is described. And we discovered that the text is actually just a smokescreen. The actual meaning of this text is hidden in the words, in the sound of the words that make up this text. And that just blew my mind. There's even the use of palindromes and similar sounding. It is like a Da Vinci Code. Where words mean one thing, but they sound like something else, and that something else is the deeper meaning that was actually intended. And when we discovered this, of course, that, you know, you can't just, that nobody's going to take you seriously if you say the pyramid text says one thing, but we think it says something else. And fortunately, a very well-respected Egyptologist from Germany, Wolfgang Helk, had already described this phenomenon in his publications decades ago. And so there was at least a precedence for this, and then we just expanded on this concept, and that passage just blew my mind, that they were that sophisticated. The whole, it's already sophisticated the way it is, the pyramid text. But to have this extra level of sophistication hiding behind an already sophisticated piece of writing, that was a huge surprise. So that's the answer to your question.
Well, that's the main way we get so there.
That's right. So there you have it, numbers and words.
Numbers and words. Well, how is it when you're there doing this, and how are the government or the agencies and even the people in the vicinity, how are they feel about you being in doing research?
Well, I am. Okay. That's a great question. I have to explain. I'm a tourist there. I'm not allowed to do research in a sense that, you know, I can't do measurements and I can't do scans or anything like that. For that, all of those things, you need to have a permit. But as a tourist, of course, you're allowed to walk around, you're allowed to take pictures and photos, and a lot of the numbers and words are published elsewhere, so you don't need to go to Egypt to research that. Those are things that you just pull down from the journals and you read up with books and stuff like that. But when you are in Egypt, you get the experience around all the data, the facts. And it's that experience that rounds it off. So to give you an example, exactly what I'm talking about. So in that same pyramid of Unas where that text is that we analyzed and published in our paper, Robert Schock and I, there's something that I did not know, and I would have never known this had I never gone to this pyramid. You couldn't go into Unas pyramid when I was there in 2017, but now it's open, so you can actually go inside. And when we went into the sarcophagus chamber where you see the pyramid text, it's mind-boggling to see all these hieroglyphs, such high quality, and then you see the sarcophagus in front of you. And then the guard all of a sudden turned off the light, and he said, I'm going to show you something. And he turned on his flashlight, and he was running the light just next to the wall, next to the south wall of the sarcophagus chamber. And all of a sudden, you see a contour appear in the wall that you would never see in regular lighting, and that contour is in the shape of Osiris. Not just Osiris, actually it's in the shape of the constellation Orion as the Egyptians saw it, with a striding figure with one finger pointed up, and that shape is imprinted life-size into the wall next to the sarcophagus. It's incredible. And that just rounded off the whole experience. So, of course, I saw this after I had published the paper, but that just further underscores it. So when you're saying, you know, what kind of research are you doing in Egypt, that's the kind of research. It's basically having a very deep emotional tourism-like experience where you take a second look. You're not just running to the monument to take selfies. You're taking a closer look and you really take it in. And that is where your ideas come from. And that's where your inspirations come from. And then you go home and you read up and you look at the numbers and the words and you make your discoveries. But in order for me to do an actual research project, I need a permit. And of course, Robert and I are currently applying for a permit to go back to Giza and do a study of the Khafre pyramid and of the tomb of Hemiunu that I just mentioned. And so we have an application going, and so we're waiting for them to review it and tell us if it's okay or not.
Well, so now that we talk about that, some of the parts of the pyramid itself. Now, throughout the years, I've heard different descriptions, and I'm going to stick to one style of description, the mystical.
Yes.
The beyond life sort of, afterlife sort of stuff. Now, there's people that say all the rooms are tuned to the same 440. There's there's a ton of different things that faces certain lights, certain stars, certain.
Right.
Now, how accurate is all of that mystical talk?
I think there is a lot of truth to it. I haven't looked at all of the objective data, but I know some of the authors in this field that have published these things, and I think they've done very careful studies, and a lot of these things are true. There's of course that has to do with the geometry of the pyramid in the first place. The pyramid is designed over a Kepler triangle, and your listeners can easily look up what a Kepler triangle is, but the essence of it is that it's based on the golden angle. And of course, the golden angle is at the heart of a lot of geometry in nature and in the universe, probably. And so it's not a surprise that there are some surprising physical properties that electromagnetism, sound, it doesn't surprise me at all. When you're inside the pyramid, everything is different. Your senses are exposed to a completely different world than outside. You ask about the star shaft. So this is a publication by Robert Bouval that was also in Orion Mystery. So he talks about the passages that emanate from the king chamber and from the queen chamber. There's one on each side, north and south. So there's a total of four passages. And so previously, it had been proposed that they were aiming to search stars of importance. And then when Robert wrote the book, he added further information to that for the other two shafts. And with those four shafts pointing to certain stars, you can date the construction of the pyramid. That's one way you can date it. It's called, you know, based on astroarchaeology or archaeoastronomy, rather. And so how valid is that? I think it's valid. I think to have four different shafts pointing to certain important areas in the sky that we know were important to the ancient Egyptians, that means something. I don't think you can just dismiss it. I think you need corroborating evidence, yes, like with anything else. But I think this is pretty compelling as a start. And then, of course, Robert proposed that the three pyramids are aligning with the belt stars of Orion. And there's a couple of astronomers recently published a paper, and they tried to falsify it, and they couldn't. They said, we cannot falsify. Basically, they couldn't falsify the alignment, and they said it is within our they basically concluded is that it could be valid. But the mystery keeps on going. There's always people that disagree. And that's okay. There's discussions. Always good to have discussions and debate. And we always can use more proof. It's okay. But these things that you've heard, I think these are all valid observations and they're real. People go inside the pyramid and they have certain experiences. I completely agree that these are valid experiences that these people are having.
Well, so what comes up next for you now? Or what's your next venture to Egypt and what do you plan on doing now?
So the next trip to Egypt is with Robert Schock in May, and we, like I was saying, we have a little research project that we're applying for, and my part of it is to confirm. I want to see if I can find physical evidence for the blueprint proposal that the tomb is a blueprint for the Great Pyramid, and then Robert has a separate project that he's pursuing. So that's on the table. Then writing wise, I'm working on two different things right now. One is a paper, that explains one of the most mysterious aspect of the Great Pyramid, which is its numerical association with the speed of light. So I'm currently investigating that and there'll be a paper out maybe in a month or so. I'm working on it right now. And then the other thing that I am working on is Göbekli Tepe, which is in Turkey. I've never been there, but Robert has been there many times, and so we're sort of in the very early exploration stage of a discovery. There's something that I saw that's very interesting, but I need a little bit more. I need to gather a little bit more information to have something that I can share with the public.
Well, now let's get the information out for everyone. Now, give us your website one more time, and also if you have any other pages up there to let people find you.
Yeah, so I think probably the two main places to go is one is my website, which is cheopspyramid.com. So Cheops is the Greek name for Khufu, Cheops, and then pyramid, Pyramid, cheopspyramid.com. It's very easy. I have a YouTube channel, and I think my YouTube channel now has actually my first and last name, so you go to YouTube and then it's custom C and then / Manu Seyfzade, I think. Or you can just Google the name and you'll find the YouTube channel. So on my YouTube channel, I produced a few videos that explain some of the concepts that I mentioned today and others in a little bit more audiovisual fashion. So it's with music and everything. So it's a different way to present the material. And then I have a academia.edu page where my publications, my papers are, and of course they're free to download. So you can find me on academia.edu and just put in my first and last name, and then that's where the papers are. And the papers, by the way, are also on my website. They are free for download. The book is, I have a hard copy for sale, and I have a Kindle version and an EPUB version, and those are also on the website. And if people are interested to come join the discussion, we have a lot of discussions on Facebook. So you can look me up on Facebook. And if you're interested in contributing to the discussion, then I'll let you in on the page.
Wow. Fantastic. I'll be jumping in on that.
Okay. Come on in.
Wow. This has been amazing. We'll have all of the sites you've mentioned and linked up on our website as well, so people, if they can't remember your name or can't remember, they can just click to our site. They'll get this interview and they'll have your website, YouTube, and all your publications right to their tips of their clipboard.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure, and I hope that you'll be able to come back again and tell us what's going on and keep us updated. We have nobody in the field that seems to be so dedicated, and your information's valuable to us. So thank you.
Absolutely. As long as I'm welcome, I'll come back, Al. It'd be a pleasure.
Always. Well, it's been a pleasure, and we've been talking about Khufu's Great Pyramid, and what we've had is a scholar and someone that's been very involved, and Manu Safe the Day.
Good.
What's our guest? Thank you.
Sure. Take care.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.